This is Andy Clark, interviewed by Chris Alden Lee on the 17th of October 2012. Andy Clark, Part 2.
So over your very long service with Bass, what are the major evolutions have you seen? Let's talk about health and safety. Was it non-existent when you first went south?
Health and safety was non-existent in the way we see it today. But to say that health and safety was non-existent at the time would be unfair. I think what we had at the time was routine common sense and an awareness of what was safe and not safe to do. As with everything, you get the occasional things wrong. So I think there was a very clear sense of what it was sensible to do and what was not sensible to do. And in terms of an environment like the Antarctic, one of the critical aspects of that was the policy at the time of doing two winters, because that meant that in any given winter, you'd have maybe half the winterers had never wintered before and hence were naive, and the other half had wintered before, maybe several times. And hence they did know what was safe and not to do. And that was a mechanism for transferring information and experience. As we move now to a period of much shorter contracts and the policy now is not to winter anybody for two consecutive winters, that carries consequences, I think, for the transfer of knowledge and experience across the generations, in the sense of cohorts of people. It doesn't take place anymore. And that's a worry. I mean, it's something like concerns me, but it's not something I have to deal with, obviously, now being retired. It's something the current people have to deal with.
So what came naturally in your early days in the 70s, best practice being passed on from one generation of FIDs to the next, one cycle of FIDs to the next, now has to get written down, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. You have to codify things in all manner of ways. The sort of code of practice for boating might run to 7 or 9 pages, and much of those 7 or 9 pages list things which are plain common sense. But in the environment in which we now operate, if you don't write those things down, and there is some indication that everyone who should have read it has read it, and something happens, all hell breaks loose. It's just the world we live in.
Did all hell break loose in your 39 years?
There have been occasions when, yes. I mean, I think the positive is the wrong phrase to say it, but an example of how things change and learning from experience was the sad event of Kirsty Brown, who was a biologist that we employed. I mean, it so happens that she wasn't my student, she was a colleague of mine, Lloyd Peck's students. We used to alternate them, and Kirsty was one who was being supervised by Lloyd and a colleague. And the way we worked that system was that the person who was supervising them went into the field in that first season with them. That was a logical way, so we helped set them up. And as is well known, Kirsty was drowned by a leopard seal. And that caused us to revise our health and safety in respect of diving in quite a serious manner. But in the end, we didn't make that many significant changes. I mean, we did make some significant changes in response to the incident, but much of what we continued to do was what we had been doing already. We just made one or two small changes. What was also interesting about that particular incident was the response of her parents, which was remarkable in my view. And that was to say straight out that they had no problems whatsoever with the way Bass had operated their diving system, and this was just one of those things that happened. And they were very, very sad to lose their daughter, but they also said, but she was doing something she'd always wanted to do, which I thought was a remarkable reaction and quite uncommon. I mean, it's not one that you would expect widely, but was real. As a result, you know, we put a ban on snorkeling in shallow water, in fact, a ban on snorkeling full stop in the Antarctic now, and we instantly switched from black, wet, dry suits to brightly coloured orange dry suits. And the reason for that being, the rationale being, Kirsty was small and she was snorkeling in the shallows amongst ice, which is what seal pups do. Mm-hmm. And our interpretation is that the leopard seal saw Kirsty as a seal pup and took her and drowned her in the way that they would drown a seal pup. So the changes are, A, make sure you don't look like a seal pup by changing your dry suits from black to orange, and B, actually don't be in the environment in the first place.
Where were you at the time?
Oh, I was back in UK. And so this happened during winter. So I had actually been on the base in that summer. It so happens that Lloyd and I coincided that year, which is not common, but it did happen that year.
How do you feel about how Bass dealt with that back here?
I didn't get directly involved. Lloyd did, because he was the line manager. Mm. And from my experience looking at it from the outside, I think they handled it fairly well. And I think that was helped by the remarkable reaction of Kirsty's parents. I think that made what was a difficult thing, made it less overwhelming than it might otherwise have been, because one could envisage, if the wrong things had happened, that all hell could break loose from above by other people covering their backs, etc. And that didn't happen. It was a difficult time, but I think broadly, from my perspective on the, and I have to emphasise, I was on the outside of that particular thing managerially, I think they handled it fairly well. As I think, in general, I mean, I remember vividly the loss of three people from Argentine Islands early on in my time at Bass, when Dick Laws was director. And this was a really tragic incident. Three people had been climbing on the mainland, and Argentine Island base, which we now call Faraday, is an island, so you have to travel across the ice or by boat, depending on the circumstances. And they had travelled overland, climbed the mountain and came back, and it was apparent that the weather was not good and the ice wasn't good, so they stopped off at a small rest safety hut. But they were keen to get back, and they made the wrong call over the safety of the ice and the weather conditions. And it was their call, and they, against advice, they decided to travel. And the ice broke out, and they got carried out to sea, and obviously died and drowned out at sea. We don't know exactly what happened, but we know in general what happened. And obviously, Dick appeared in front of the local media. I remember he was interviewed on television and was asked, you know, about training. And he explained, and I thought it was remarkably fair and balanced. He said, we do train people. We give them excellent training. We give them advice. But in the end, he said, you have to recognise that part of the attraction of this environment to some people is that it puts them in a situation where they have to make a decision. All the times they make the right decision because we've trained them, you don't hear about. On this occasion, it's very sad, but they made the wrong decision. And I thought there was no covering up. I thought that was excellent. And I think, in general, that's how Bass has reacted to the, thankfully, very small number of incidents. I mean, if you look at the statistics, you know, you're much more likely to be killed in the UK than you are in the Antarctic, given the age and everything else. But accidents do happen, and they have to be dealt with, and lessons have to be learnt. And I think General Bass has done that.
A question from Inigo Everson. You were head of division for a number of years under three directors, each with differing management styles. What were the most favourable features of the management style of those different directorates that you would encourage adoption under the present regime, and why?
That's a typical Inigo question. I would say, yes, I did have three directors. They were very different.
Dick Laws, Barry Hayward and David Drury.
Yeah, and actually four, Chris Rapley. I was also under Chris Rapley. They differed in a number of features. One thing they differed in, I think, which is more relevant than might seem, is their scientific credibility.
Tell me more.
Dick Laws came with a very strong science reputation, which was thoroughly deserved. He'd worked in Africa on elephants. And we always joked that Dick only worked on big things, elephants, rhinos, elephant seals, whales. But Dick had an established reputation when he arrived at Bass. He's also a formidable person. And so in that sense, he had gravitas and clout, and you knew who the boss was without anybody saying. But he wasn't particularly collegiate, and I only overlapped with him very slightly. I never actually was formally head of division under Dick. Barry was a director who was very good with people, but didn't have the science background or science credibility that Dick did. David Drury came from the Scott Polar Research Institute, which meant he carried some credibility with him. And he, I think, was the most collegiate of the directors that I worked with closely. I clashed with David on a number of instances, and one of which I think I got right and one of which I clearly got wrong. I was dead set against the introduction of the Dash 7 aircraft because I thought this was stretching our finances too far and wasn't going to deliver anything of any meaningful logistic capability. I turned out to be wrong. It's actually been a terrific thing. Although the centrepiece of our disagreement centred on whether or not we should fit skis. And in the end, the decision was taken not to fit skis because that was getting very, very expensive. And that was my main concern. As it is, the other fix we did, which was to put a cargo door in, it actually turned out to be a positive bonus for Bass because we licensed it and we got money back for it. And the Dash 7s turned out to be brilliant. So I accept that.
What did he get right?
It was really the speed with which we introduced women was, I think, one area where David was keen but slightly reluctant, I think. So I think that's one where we pushed. And the other area where we clashed was, I think, there was an incident over... I had an informal interview with David and Barry, who was deputy at the time, over how well the Marine Life Sciences was performing. And I thought we were doing quite well. And I went up one day and had an interview where I came out with my ears burning because I'd been told that we were not up to scratch and, you know, we weren't publishing enough, etc. And I went out thinking, well, I don't see where that's coming from. So I actually asked David, I said, you know, what's the evidence? You know, if you say we're not up to scratch, you must have a standard in your mind against which you're comparing us. You know, what's the standard? And I couldn't get an answer. It was just, well, we don't think you're doing well enough. And so I pushed hard to say, well, you know, tell me what you think I should be doing. You know, I need a standard. I need a number. You know, tell me, is it the number of publications? If they're not enough, how many do you expect? I pushed hard. I probably pushed too hard. And I didn't get an answer because actually there wasn't an answer. So I went off and I spent 3 months quietly in the evenings generating some data. And I was able to I produced a paper. It was only about 4 pages long, which belied the amount of work that went into it, where I analysed the output of our seagoing scientists. It was particularly our seagoing scientists that was the nub of the criticism, and used the only other seagoing programme that was at all comparable in the UK. And I was able to demonstrate that we were 4 times more productive than that university-based. No, it wasn't university-based. It was joint university and NERC-based at another institute. And I was able to say they are. But as always, of course, with the trick with management is to never admit you're wrong. And I never got an acknowledgement that actually it had been wrong. We simply moved on to other topics. But that's the specific case. In general, I thought David was very good for Bass. He's very good at profile. He was excellent at sort of manoeuvring Bass into the right places and making sure Bass and David Drury were seen in the right places. And it did a tremendous amount for our image. He was very good. In dealing with him on the day-to-day running of Bass, I found him easy to deal with. He was collegiate. He listened. Usually we did what David thought was the right thing, but there was genuine discussion and we could change his mind. With Chris Rapley, that wasn't the case. He was the one that I had least empathy with at the end. We had very different views on management style, and we had very different views on how you treated people. And in the end, it became very difficult. And it was decided the best thing would be for my health and also other things if I stepped sideways. So
Chris had not been to the Antarctic. He was brought in from a different world, wasn't he?
Yeah.
Are there pros and cons in that?
No. In general, as a philosophical point, I think bringing people in from the outside is good. It's a just sort of broad brush statement. And I think it was particularly good for Bass when we started recruiting from without at senior levels rather than recruiting from within, because I think we had become quite narrow in our view and narrow in our experience. I remember vividly we brought in Frank Curry, who came from the MOD director. Interesting guy, Frank. He and I clashed occasionally, but we remained on very good terms. I mean, you're working colleagues and you have disagreements at times, but we ended up most of the time as very good colleagues. And a lot of time for Frank. And I remember vividly him coming into one of the first directors' committees and sitting and saying, well, know, we need to produce a 5-year plan. Can I see your 5-year plan? To which the response was along the lines of, what is a 5-year plan? So Frank brought in a rigour and view, and actually that turned into a major restructuring event, because he produced a 5-year plan and then came back to the directors' committee and said, if we don't make some major changes, you will have to make most of your science staff redundant in 5 years' time, because this is the way the figures are going. Mm. And we ended up on what became known as the Way Forward restructuring programme, which was an interesting introduction to management for me, because it meant I had to wrestle with the problem of seeing the big picture at the management board and having to sell the changes to the staff who were going to be affected. And that was an interesting time to me. Because the first thing I did when I took over was rearrange the structure of the research groups. And that didn't go down too well with some of my colleagues, because effectively we had a system I'd inherited where every middle manager was effectively a manager of a research group, often a research group of one. And I just amalgamated them, which effectively is disenfranchising people in some ways. But I felt it was a necessary thing to do, and I did it. Wasn't popular. But in the end, I only lost one member of staff who threw their toys out of their thing and moved on. Everyone else stayed around and lived with it and actually made it work. Again, you don't get people coming back up and saying, actually, I was wrong, it was the right thing to do. But we started to do some good stuff, and I think people recognised that the change was necessary. The change that Frank Curry's analysis introduced was far more widespread, and that was the suggestion that we close Signy, close Faraday. The Foreign and Commonwealth Office wouldn't allow us to close Signy, so we had to have Way Forward Part 2, because we had to go back. And the Foreign and Commonwealth Office wouldn't accept our first round of proposals. So we went back and we moved biology from Sydney to Rothera, which was a real problem for some people who were emotionally attached to Sydney. But we did it, and I think it's proved generally a good thing. I would admit that we did lose some opportunities for terrestrial biology by moving from Sydney to Rothera, but I still feel that what we gained outweighed what we lost.
You've answered a lot of Lloyd Peck's questions by saying that. So, did you enjoy, let's face it, you're a biologist, did you enjoy management?
Yes and no. I did enjoy management when I was working for directors that I had some empathy with. And when I was appointed, the rules of the game were, there's a contract you signed effectively. I mean, you didn't actually physically sign a contract at that time, but the post you accepted was one which was akin to the old head of department in university, which is that you were expected to do what you'd always done, academic work, research, but also manage the department or manage the division. And that split was always deemed to be the two facets of the job. Managing to do both facets of the job was a real struggle, but there was a recognition that both were important. And I'd always viewed I mentioned it before already, that the sort of credibility as a scientist was important if you're going to manage scientists. That's something I've always felt and remain. I look around at society in general and feel that can be generalised to society in general. I don't believe in bringing in professional managers from the outside, you know, because you've run the post office, you can now run the FA or vice versa. Mm. I don't think that necessarily works. So at that stage, I enjoyed management. There was a lot of tedium to it, a lot of frustration to it. As my father, he never gave me any advice. He just made a comment once that 95% of your problems will be caused by 5% of the people. And that's exactly right. And you have to deal with those people, and you try and make life as positive for them as you can. And what I particularly enjoyed was the ability to create opportunities for people that you saw potential in. You can't do it for them, but what you can do is open a door, point a direction, or in the case of women scientists, open the door to get them in. And that was very rewarding. I look back on that and think, yeah, I actually enjoyed that. And I got feedback from it. You know, the people would come up to you, and people did come up to me when I retired and said some very nice things. I thought, oh, I obviously did something that people appreciated. when it came to working with Chris, we were just very different personalities, and I did not enjoy that at all. And hence I got out. And to Chris's credit, he recognised that we had to make a difference, and he was quite instrumental at smoothing the path for me to do something which is not easy to do in the civil service, and that's to move out of management back into science. It doesn't compute in the system.
Can you elaborate a bit more about the final straw that made you resign? This is the Patrick McGoohan number 6 question, isn't it? Why did he resign from the
Department? Yeah, I had a small mental breakdown. That was quite straightforward.
Instigated by being at Bass?
Tension, yeah. Just the tension of trying to manage. Under Chris had a very different view of what the heads of divisions were there for, which was that in his view, it was quite straightforward. You shouldn't be doing science. In fact, if you did science, you were actually being disrespectful to the people you were managing, because you were spending time not managing. And that was his view. And that was not what I'd signed up for initially, and not what most of the division heads had signed up for. So it was an element of the goalposts being moved whilst you were still in post.
Had your scientific work suffered because you were also doing managerial?
No, it had changed. I mean, I when I took on the job, at the time when you could still do science, there was a recognition that I had to do a different type of science. I couldn't, for example, do lab work, because a lab experiment would involve you being in the lab, you know, 2 days continuously, or I had to go and take this out of the water bath at 12 o'clock, or I had to do X or I had to do Y. There's no way you can do that in a managerial job. So I did a different type of science. Partly I was able to, I had a research assistant with me, and she, because they were almost all women, could do the work in the lab. And we would interact, and I'd be down the lab every day checking that everything was okay. But my interaction might be 5 minutes that day, and the rest of the time I'm doing management stuff. Mm. But the science is carrying on, and I have to write it up in the evening. Or you write more review type or reflective type articles that aren't dependent on your being in the lab or in the field all the time. But I kept up a field work, and when I went to the Antarctic for a season at Rothera, I would do a science project, but it wouldn't be a full-time science project. I'd be in the lab doing stuff, but at the same time, I'd also help out with the management of the lab and the management of the base.
So was it Rapley's decision to withdraw your scientific role, your direct science role, completely? Was that the final straw?
That was a part of the tension. I mean, I think there was a tension because Chris's managerial style, which is very autocratic, was not to my taste. It was very non-collegiate. There was a board, but basically the board's function there was to agree to what people wanted. It wasn't just Chris, it was more complex than that, but essentially it felt no longer collegiate. I think in the end, sort of trying to resolve those tensions internally led to medical problems. And so the medical grounds were the ones which were an acceptable face to enable
something.
So you
got a sick note, effectively?
I didn't actually go as far as a physical note. It was recognised. One of my colleagues, actually, it was David Walton, actually, who went to Chris and actually said, "You have to do something, Chris. Otherwise, you know, there will be a medical case on your record," basically. That was the way I believe he phrased it. I mean, I wasn't present at the time. But
what about NERC? Was NERC a contribution to your disheartening?
No, it wasn't. And actually, I have to say that when it was decided that the resolution should be that I moved out of management and someone else would take over running the division after 10 years and I would move back to being science, credit where it's due, Chris and John Hansen at NERC, John Hansford at NERC, were both very supportive of that move. So Chris, I think, recognising that he had to do something, then actually was very good.
Will this be John Lawton?
And John Lawton was the chief executive at the time. So, and I got tremendous support from John, as someone I've known for some time. I think he's an ecologist, so I'd known John previously.
But in your exit essay, when you left the organisation completely, you were actually quite critical of NERC, aren't you?
Yes, I mean,
Was that something which came in the last 10 years?
Our relationship with NERC has been up and down all the time. I mean, I think to finish answering the first question, I wouldn't say that the difficulties that I experienced working with NERC contributed to the problem that led to my moving sideways. That was, I think, purely internal in Bass.
Right.
That was my attempting to resolve impossible things to resolve in Bass. And if you can't resolve them, they build up. And eventually we resolved it by my changing the job.
And were you happier?
Oh, yeah, instantly. Yeah, I mean, yes, yeah.
So what was the problem with NERC then? Because
the problem with NERC, I think, is it goes back to a structure. I mean, it's not a problem. Perhaps I should distinguish. I have always felt that Bass has had problems with NERC. And as I was a part of senior management in Bass, then those difficulties I felt quite sharply. I don't think there was an individual problem with me as an individual. It was more the Bass-NERC relationship. And that goes back to the way Bass is organised. And it's effectively a structural conflict in that you have the Foreign Commonwealth Office, which is the reason we exist effectively, but they don't fund us. What is now BIS, Business, Industry and Science Department, funds us. Its name changes at regular intervals. But basically you have an organisation that is your rationale for existence and has part of a say in what you do, and another organisation that provides the money and hence would like to dictate what you do. And that tension has always been there. And it means that at times the relationship can be good and at times the relationship cannot be good. And it depends very much on the individuals concerned at the senior levels in all of those organisations. So the nature of that relationship was critically dependent on who was the chief executive of NERC, who was the person responsible at the FCO, and who was the director of Bass. And that trio was critical. And at times where that relationship worked, Bass-NERC relationships were very good. And I would quote the time when John Lawton was chief executive as being a very good one. Mm. Previously, I would go back to Eileen Buttle. And prior to that, I know, talking with Inigo, that he would cite Ray Beverton. But Ray, I was so junior in the organisation, when Ray was chief executive, it really didn't hit my radar, so I can't comment on that. The two I can comment on are Eileen Buttle and John Lawton, who I think have both been sympathetic to what Bass is trying to achieve, sympathetic to the FCO's aim, but also keen to drive up science standards everywhere. Other chief executives or other directors of Bass, the relationship has not been so good. And when the relationship's bad, it's not good for you when you have a bad relationship with the person who is actually handling your money.
But one of your frustrations seems to be that you seem to have greater scientific recognition outside the UK than you did.
I think that's true of most polar scientists, actually. I think that's...
Why is that?
I think it's partly the history of polar science. It's partly valid, but is, I think, in some ways no longer valid. In the early days, polar scientists worked in polar regions on polar problems, and they were largely divorced, not entirely, but they were often divorced from the mainstream of there are science going on elsewhere. And that varied a lot depending on whether you were dealing with a biologist or a physicist or a geologist. So I'm speaking here essentially from a biological perspective. And a lot of what we were doing in those early days was descriptive, finding out how the land lay, sorting out what was there, who was there, how many of them were there. Really basic stuff. Stuff that was done 200 years ago in the UK. And that, I think, led to a feeling that the stuff that these guys were doing in the Antarctic actually wasn't very exciting. And actually, it wasn't very exciting. But it was absolutely essential. And we tended to publish it in non-mainstream Antarctic journals. So starting with Dick, driven on by David Drury, but also driven on particularly by John Lawton as the chief executive, or before his time as chief executive, when he was commenting on our science, either formally or informally, there was a pressure to say, well, you guys have got to come into the mainstream. And we did. And that's, I think, something which happened significantly in the years that I was in management and subsequently. I mean, I tried to move things in that direction by persuading people, I'm going to put this into the Bass Bulletin. Think, well, no, don't put it in there. You've got something interesting to say. Put it in a general ecology journal. And that was a slow transition. And now it's routine. People don't look at polar journals at all. People now look to get their stuff in Science and Nature and whatever. So we've made the move. Mm-hmm. However, there is still, I think, in the community at large in biology, a feeling that actually the really exciting biology is done at Imperial College in Oxford and Cambridge. And the rest of you are really second raters. And there used to be a third rater category for people in the polar regions, but that's changed a bit now. So there is an element of history in it, but I think it is, it has been a frustration for many scientists. So, you know, there has been many scientists in Bath who've had very high reputations abroad, but are just unrecognised in the UK. Because all communities have sub-communities and cliques within them. And the ecology community in the UK is uninterested, really, in what is going on in the ecology of elsewhere.
Let me quote. I can recall no instance when NERC has asked of its institutes what he might do to help improve, develop or support the science undertaken within those institutes. And none of the major scientific advances that have emanated from NERC institutes in the past have ever been the result of such top-down direction. All have developed the grassroots within the institutes and gone up.
Yeah, I'd still... Yeah.
Hard stuff.
Yes, I mean, I think that's true. I mean, there's two elements to that. I mean, I think the second point is I would argue that almost all science advances come from grassroots. It's very, very rare, I think, for a science manager somewhere sitting to say, I think we should do X, and it's resulting in a large major-scale advance. Scientists sit in bars and talk, and what do you reckon about doing this? And that's how ideas develop. Mm. Sometimes they develop into something which is really significant. Often they don't. But the really powerful advances actually come from the grassroots up. The first comment, I think, is symptomatic of how all central administrations work. Mm. They know better. But I use those words quite deliberately because a colleague of mine used to run a NERC institute, and he moved abroad to run an American institute. And I met him soon after he'd moved. Mm. I was at a conference in California, and we sat in the bar. And I said, I'm getting on really well, really enjoying it. You know, haven't got my green card yet, so I can't buy a car because you can't do anything without a credit card, and I haven't got a credit card without a green card. So he was talking about the difficulties of moving. He said, but I had a really interesting weekend. He said, I went to visit the sponsors of the lab. Like American labs, like many American labs, are actually a large amount of their income is philanthropy. Mm. And so you have the X, Mr. X building, the Professor Y, because they're the people who funded it. Mm. So he, as the new director of the lab, he went to the funding people and had dinner with them. And he said, I was standing around. They gave me gin and tonic and said, there you are. I'm just going to finish the meal. Please meet these people who sponsor the lab. And one of them came over and said, ah, Professor, I'm pleased to meet you. I'm so-and-so. What we need you to tell us now you're here is what we can do to make the science in the lab better. And he turned around to me and said, I worked 25 years in NERC and nobody ever asked me that question. Okay. And I thought, it's true. But it's partly symptomatic of how hierarchical organisations work. You know, the central structure of NERC used to be a very small directorate that handled money and did things. It's now become the centrepiece, and it likes to direct from the centre outwards or downwards. And that's...
I was quoting from your NERC exit questionnaire, which you must have written about 2009. Okay. Any scary incidents, accidents or near misses? Yes, we do not mention these, is your reply. Well, actually, this is when we do mention some of them. Well, did you ever fear for your life?
Yes. When I wrote that answer, I had one particular event in mind. I mean, obviously, there are things when you go back and go, that could have gone the wrong way. Mm. And sometimes you think, I need to say something about that because we've not encountered that before. And sometimes you think, what a stupid idiot. And that's just, I mean, I'm human like anyone else. In the days when I was at South Georgia, we had a policy for outdoor recreation, which meant that you could roam freely over a large area of terrain solo. And we all used to do that. And you know, I've always liked being on my own. When I'm out in the field. I enjoy birding with other people, but I actually like being in the outside world on my own. South Georgia was heaven for that because you could go for all day walking across terrain. And on one occasion, I had wanted to get from A to B, and it involved crossing a small piece of ice. Mm-hmm. And that ice disappeared over the horizon and down. And it was small, and I decided I would go across without putting crampons on. And I slipped and had to do an ice axe arrest. And I amazed myself with the speed with which something I'd only practiced actually happened in reality. I did actually have my ice axe with me and I was carrying it properly, so I was able to do an ice axe arrest. And then I'm stuck in the middle of the ice thinking, well, now I'm hanging on this ice axe. I now have to get myself back without crampons. And I'm on a slope like that. And I know that that slope goes a long, long way. And if I slipped, I'm not likely to have recovered. So I had to kick myself into the ice backwards, and I had extremely bruised feet for quite some time, though I never revealed to anybody at the time.
It wasn't in the Beige Report?
No, you didn't mention things like that at the time. I just got back and said, basically, I got to the other side, sat down for a while, had a class, probably had a cup of coffee and a biscuit or something, or a snacky bar or something to calm down and think, well, that was stupid and I've learned something from that, and left it at that. You know, that was a lesson to me, and I never mentioned it to anybody.
Till today?
Till today, yeah.
Anything that made you laugh out loud?
Oh, there's probably been loads of those. I suppose I do have a sense of humour, and so there have been lots of... Can I think of anything that that's specific at the moment? Probably not.
All right.
But in general, I mean, there is a lot of humour down there, and FIDs are notorious for having a black sense of humour. And there have been many incidences of such things. But I mean, I can't think of one offhand, but yes. I think, you know, it's the famous thing, a sense of humour must be maintained at all times. And I think of the people who are successful in the FIDS environment, a sense of humour is the thing that probably helps carry them forward.
Tell me about working with the Americans. What were the big differences between the United States Antarctic Programme and BASS?
Oh, many and varied. I did two trips with the Americans, one to McMurdo in 1989, I think, and then 1979. God, terrible, isn't it? 1979-80 season at McMurdo, and then the 84 season at Palmer Station. And those are the two seasons that I've done with the Americans, full seasons. They were both
as invited visitors.
Yes, different invitees, different people inviting me. And I thoroughly enjoyed both experiences. McMurdo was interesting. McMurdo was my first experience of a mixed station, so that was interesting. And I thought there were elements of that that were really quite favourable, elements which were typically American and bizarre. I will quote one which might seem a bit tasteless in a way, but it isn't, because it reflects an incident the previous year. But there's a medical centre at McMurdo which has pregnancy testing kits but no condoms. That summed up, I think, very often what I found an extremely frustrating environment bureaucratically to work in. As an example, a telex came in to me, and there was a system where a flag went up when there's a message, and you go and pick your mail up, because the aircraft are coming in all the time, so mail's quite frequent. And if there's mail arrived, the flag went up, and I went in to check. And I was in there, and somebody said, oh, did you get your telex message? What telex message? Oh, there was a telex message for you. So I had to go over to the chalet, which was the head office there, which was built like a Swiss chalet. So that was why it was so called. There was the head office, and I went and knocked on the door, and said, I believe there's a telex message for me. Name? Yeah, there was a message. I said, well, can I see it? I don't know. Yeah, I guess so. And it turned out these things print off on sort of multiple copies, and they filed all four copies into the relevant files. The only person who didn't see the message was the person for whom it was a trivial message. So there was frustration. But scientifically, I would say I was really impressed with the quality of the science that was being done. What was also impressive was the scale of the science that could be undertaken. It was massively greater than we could do. But then it's a huge investment. McMurdo was a huge station. It's got helicopters, it's got C-130 transport, it's got twin otters coming in and out. They can do things that we can't do. And I was also impressed by the positive effect on the science of having a large number of university academics coming through rather than working internally as we did. So it convinced me of a number of things that trip. And
you're passing through in quick succession? Yeah.
Yes, quite often. Or sometimes you only saw them briefly before they went in deep field. Mm. And sometimes they'd be there for relatively short periods of time. But I think what I took from those two experiences were a series of things. One is having women on a station improves the social environment. The second was that actually, there's an awful lot of very smart science women out there, and we're missing a trick if we don't employ them. And the third one was actually having a mix of internal and university people is actually going to be beneficial. Internally, we've got some good people and some not so good people. No organisation is universally brilliant. every organisation has good, mediocre and not so good people. And we were no exception to that. Universities have good, not so good and mediocre people as well. But if you can get the mix right, that's great. And lastly, I was also impressed by what students and postdocs brought, youngsters brought. And so those sort of all went into my consciousness, and they all had an influence on the way I approached management when I got the chance to do it, because I felt I acted on most of those. And it was carrying through from the experience that made me convinced that there were things, there were benefits we could bring. There was much about the American system which I just found bizarre and off the wall, but there were many strengths to it. So the trick is to pick the good bits and leave the bizarre bits aside.
Let's look at one or two of your seasons in a bit more detail. Ones you pointed out in your notes. One was, effectively your first season, the 71 winter at South Georgia, where you said that the group, the party, did not gel at all.
No.
In retrospect, can you find a reason for that?
Yes. I think, it was down to the choice of base commander.
Right.
It was the wrong choice of base commander, in my view. We were all young, inexperienced. No one had ever had to do a job like this before, and it didn't work. It resulted, it was 13 wintering party, I think, and it evolved into 12 plus one. And that's never good.
You mean 12 versus one?
Yes, 12 and one would be a better way. Occasionally versus, but more 12 and one would be a more honest way of putting it, I think. There were occasions when it got very difficult. It was actually difficult through much of that winter. And the party just never gelled socially or anything else. I mean, there were many aspects of the winter I enjoyed, and the science, I was picking up a new science programme, that was going well. But at the time, it was my first winter, and I remember thinking, I remember toying with the idea of whether I would do a second winter. Then the summer came along and it was great, and the second winter turned out to be actually a major success.
Well, in contrast, you put that down as one of your most memorable seasons.
It was
72 at South Georgia.
It was absolutely terrific. We had a bigger party, 25 people maybe, I think, that winter. Good mix of people. And we had another young, naive base commander, a guy called Jerry Tallowin, who was an exact contemporary of mine. I was the two-winter marine person. Jerry was the two-winter terrestrial person. He was a botanist. I still see Jerry. He hasn't changed at all. And he turned out to be really good. He handled it very, very well. And the base gelled, and we did some terrific things. And at the end of it, you know, the morale at the end of the winter when the ship came in for relief was extremely high. We'd had a great winter. That was memorable. I mean, for lots of things that happened, but all small things. You just came away thinking that was a great time.
When you were establishing Rotherham, and I'm afraid I forget what year that was now, but you'll know.
97. Well, the switch. The last season at Sydney was 94, but we didn't get into Rotherham until 97.
Okay.
So there was a hiatus in that sense.
What do you remember of that establishment of Rotherham, of the difficulties and the things that went better than expected?
I think it was actually a very positive experience all round, I think. We'd moved from an ancient base with old labs to a brand new lab. And it was terrific. We had space, we had a customised aquarium, we had an exciting new area to explore, and it was a new area. It was far south. I felt I was in the genuine Antarctic. I was on the edge of Marguerite Bay, which was an area that carried a mystique for FIDS, I think. You know, I guess you probably experienced, the Marguerite Bay community is a very distinct community within FIDS. Because it was essentially the travelling community. That was where the dog sledging took place. So that Marguerite Bay community was a very distinct community. And I loved the fact that I wasn't dog sledding, but I was on the edge of Marguerite Bay. And that with the history of that sort of area in Bass, that meant something to me. It probably didn't mean as much to other people, but it meant something to me. That was great. The new lab was terrific. Having access to aircraft was terrific. I saw a whole side to Bass that I'd only known about in sort of committees and heard about. So suddenly I could experience what these guys did in the field. It meant also that I moved on to a multidisciplinary base. So I shared the bar with glaciologists and geologists in a way that you didn't at Sydney, because you were biology only at Sydney. And so it gave, I think if you took the opportunity, it gave you an outlook that you didn't otherwise have. And I ended up socialising with engineers who look after aircraft. Things like that. You know, it broadened my experience in lots of ways. So I loved it. And then the lab burnt down and we had to rebuild.
That's my next question, the Bonner Lab.
Burnt
down in September 2001.
Yeah.
And how did you cope with that?
Well, first thing to say is I've had three memorable phone calls in Bass. One of them involved Chris Rapley, and I'm not going to go into that one. The second one was to say the Bonner Lab's on fire. And the third one was to tell me about Kirsty. And those two, the Bonner Lab and Kirsty, I took the phone call at home. And that was just, well, I rushed straight into Bass and they said, well, you know, it's still alight and we've got everyone, you know, there's no problem, there's no one in there, etc. You know, it was fine. But under the circumstances, which I then learnt about, we had to let it burn down. I mean, that was the only safe thing that you could do.
This was 2001, so 2001. No telephones yet.
Was there VoIP? No, there were. I don't know the answer to that, actually.
I
think it was satellite phones, but there wasn't the VoIP, voice over internet protocol that we have now. So, I mean, there wasn't a question of picking up the phone
You were getting the news as it was happening.
Yes, so there must have been a phone call. There must have been a phone call. Basically, the base leader at the time rang and said, the lab is on fire. And that elicited the emergency response in NERC, in Bass and in NERC, which people came piling in to sort it out. But, I mean, you can't sort out much from the Cambridge end, except to ratify the decision to let it burn down. Mm. And, you know, and basically say, do not go. You know, this is the curtain, 1 kilometre or half kilometre or whatever it was.
So was there a will amongst the Rothera team at that time to try and fight this fire?
Yes, they did attempt to, but they used there is a firefighting truck because it's for aircraft. So they got the firefighting truck down the runway. The runway, of course, at that time was not in operation because it was winter, so they had to get it down through snow and ice. And the problem was that the wind was so strong that the water wasn't actually landing on the base. It was being pumped into the air and then blown sideways. So they couldn't actually, and you couldn't get the fire truck onto the other side of the lab. You had to do it from the side of the airstrip. And the water simply wasn't reaching it. And at that point, they said, we can't fight the fire. And the order was given back off, right back up to the main station, watch it burn. Because we knew as the fire moved down to the southern end of the building, which is where the air compressor and bottles were, that there were going to be some loud bangs. And there were. In fact, when one of the air bottles went off, the main base shook. And that's half a kilometre away.
What involvement did you have in the replacement of that lab?
It was interesting. Quite a lot. In my sort of managerial capacity, I was on the design team of Bonner Lab 1. That meant my input was to say, this is how we'd like the lab laid out scientifically, and interact with the guys on the building side and say, well, that's great, but we can't do that because, but how about this? That sort of interaction. But basically, we got the lab we wanted. In the first year of operation, we realised we got a couple of things wrong. Small things, trivial things.
Such as?
The placement of the labs and the arrangement. The placement of the offices and the arrangement of the offices. It's small and psychological, but critical. What we did was that there's a central main entrance, which we thought was sensible. And the idea was that you went into the main entrance, you turned left for the dirty areas. That's the aquarium, the rough lab, the scuba, dirty and wet. And you turn right for the clean and dry areas. So all the offices and dry laboratories were to the right. And we actually started with offices and then labs. But that meant that half the offices looked out at the view and the other half of the offices looked at the slag heap, which was the vertical face of cliff from which the rock had been blasted to generate the runway. And actually that wasn't sensible. If you're going to have asked people to winter for 2 winters at the time we were, and you're going to give them an office in which today is going to be their personal space, it was much more sensible to give the offices the view and the labs the view of the slag heap. And that's when we did redesign Bonner Lab 2. That's what we did. And I went to the management guy or the building guy and said, you know, how about doing this? He said, oh, thank goodness you said that. He said, that's great because I can put all the facilities down one side. So he, from a structural point of view, he was... So
Bonner Lab 2 was post-2001.
Yes, and we got It shows the value of having political visitors. The season before it burnt down, we had hosted Baroness Scotland, who at the time was in charge of the Foreign Commonwealth Office and the elements that ran Antarctica. So she was the high-ranking politician with responsibility for Antarctica. She came down, and she was a total success. I was extremely impressed with her as a person, and also impressed with the way that she dealt with the visit. She was one of the most impressive visitors we've had, as well as being a delightful individual. And she went away thoroughly impressed by what Nurk had done. And Chris Rapley, who was co-hosting it, was part of that impression. I mean, he worked hard to give a good impression of Bass. We had a decision to rebuild the lab within days of the lab burning down. And that came, we believe, directly from Baroness Scotland. You never know how the wheels of power actually turn. But we believe that she was instrumental in getting that. And so we were able to start planning immediately to the rebuild. And we were able to put in action some of the corrections to the minor elements of the building that we found on experience we'd got wrong. I mean, 90% of it we found was right. So, you know, if you knew Bonner Lab 1, you could walk in Bonner Lab 2 and know where almost everything was, because it was exactly the same.
I couldn't help noticing that the library is called the Andy Clark Library.
Yeah.
How did that happen?
It was my last season, and there was a cohort of students and postdocs down there, and Nick Owens was down for his, what turned out to be his last visit down there, and I gave a science talk, and I was
in the lab.
In the lab, I was naive. No, I gave a science talk up in the bar actually, and I made a point of every season I went down, I always gave a science talk, because I wanted to explain to the guys in the station as a whole what it was the Bonner Lab did, because the Bonner Lab is down the road, and all the scientists go down, and a lot of construction crew or general support people don't feel happy going into the environment. It's not that they're unwelcome, it's just that they themselves don't feel it's appropriate for them to go in the door.
Qualified.
So I used to give a talk and say, well, look, I just want to give you a simple talk as to what we're doing out there and why we're doing it. And I'd give a half-hour talk in the bar. It was deliberately timed before dinner, so people could have a beer when I'm talking, and then wander in. And anyone's got any questions, I'm happy to answer them. And it's a very generalised talk, and I gave that. And then Nick gave a speech afterwards to say I was about to leave and said some very nice things about me. And then it turned out that he'd been down to talk to the students and postdocs and said, is there anything you'd like to do? And they said, yes, we would like to name the library. And hence it happened. So I was very touched, actually. And it was a complete surprise. It was organised entirely at grassroots level. So that was very touching. Yeah.
In the summer of 2004/5, at Rotherham, alcohol became a problem. Can you talk me through this, please?
Well, I think...
Not for you personally, though, I suppose.
I hope not.
in case I gave the wrong impression there.
Now, well, I'm sure, as you know, in my time at South Georgia, as all 20-year-olds do, I probably had my moments. I think one of the problems that we have to deal with managerially as an organisation is the fact that we employ a lot of young people, and they bring with them the lifestyle and approach to life that is characteristic of UK as a whole. And so where social patterns change in UK as a whole, they change in Antarctica. And one of the things that's changed in the UK and has hence impacted on Antarctica is a change in the approach to alcohol. At South Georgia in the 70s, this sounds like the classic when I was a lad talk, but you need to set it in a sort of context. It was not unusual to have a can of beer for lunch. Quite a lot of people would come up to lunch in the main building in Shackleton House, go into the bar, take a single can of beer and take it through and have a beer with their lunch. They'd have a cup of coffee afterwards. They'd maybe fall asleep in a chair because they got a one-hour lunch break or whatever. And then they go back and carry on. And in the evenings, they might have a beer or two in the bar. And then Saturday nights, there would generally be a bar night, which meant that more beer was drunk. And on Saturday night, occasionally, some people were a little the worse for wear. I never saw in my time, 2 years at South Georgia, anyone on the Bass side completely out of it with alcohol. There were people who would go to bed merry, and maybe just a little bit more than merry, but nothing that I would regard as anything other than the odd night where they're going to have a headache in the morning. I have seen Russian seamen visiting go home very much the worse for wear. And that's changed now. And the shift is where it's now unheard of for people to have alcohol at lunchtime. It's just unheard of. And with that is also a tendency to view the evening as drinking time. And so with that has come a number of other changes. For example, when we first went to the Bonner Lab, it was not unusual for almost the entire lab to go back down the road after dinner. And that meant putting your outdoor gear on because you've got to walk down the road and then go into the lab. And, you know, it may be if it was the marine assistant or one of the technicians, he or she might actually be doing emails or organising photographs. But the default was you went back down to the lab. And then maybe around 9 or 10 o'clock you went up to the bar and had a drink at the end of the day, nightcap, whatever it might be. That's changed now. There's now very much a perception that if you go down to the lab in the evening, you're actually not looking after the social life of the station. And the social life of the station is to get drunk in the bar in the evenings. And not all of us necessarily want to do that. Now, some of us don't want to do it because we've got older. But there are also some younger people who don't want to do it either. So that change in the approach to alcohol is a UK-wide shift, and it has its impact on the station, since it's basically that you get drunk in the evenings. And Bass has tried all manners of ways to try and control, regulate, influence that, and none of them have really been successful, in my view. But we do have odd years when it causes a real problem, and that season was one of them.
So describe the problem.
One individual who had come to the end of their second winter was ready to go home. We have, you know, there is a well-known saying that, you know, there are some people who do their third summer and are happy to do it and leave at the end of it having had a good time. There are some people who need to be shifted home on the first available flight or put ship out because they've come to the end of their time. And it's, you know. And if you're in that position and you're not going home, then alcohol is one of the ways that people take to relieve whatever tensions and pressures they have. We had an individual who was using alcohol in that way and was getting riotously drunk most evening, but was also doing it in a way that pulled other people in, so that there was a gradually increasing corpus of people, mainly on the construction and support side. In this case, it isn't always the case, but in this case it was, who were often unfit for work the next morning. And I just felt that was not right, as did the people on the base at the time.
And the base commander, again, pointing at no individuals, the base commanders found it difficult to actually control that.
Yes.
They had no sanctions.
It had no sanctions. And actually, this was it turned out this was a seminal event, because I, as the senior scientist and a member of the director's committee at the time, automatically helped out with the management board for the station. The station was so complicated that we had a little management committee that would meet to decide things. It was often only a half-hour meeting, but it was good. And I represented both the science lab and also, to some extent, HQ in that meeting. And I had some long heart-to-hearts with the base commander at the time, was a good friend. And we said, we have to ship this guy out. And it's not an easy decision to make. And the base commander at the time felt this was a last resort, and he'd never, ever, in a long period of time at Bass, ever shipped anybody out, and decided this one had to go. And he transmitted that with my support and documentation and everything else. We did it all above board, transmitted it back to UK, and it was countermanded on the grounds that there wasn't the right sequence of verbal and written warnings and everything else that had to be. And so if it was challenged, Bass, you know, the people back home might actually get hauled into a tribunal and been found wanting. And so they were covering their backsides. And this individual stayed and caused more disruption. The base commander in question left Bass soon afterwards for a number of reasons, of which that lack of support was a critical one, because I spoke with him several times over coffees and quietly, and I know. So it was very unsatisfactory all round. And it was part also of there are lots of factors involved in that season, but you know, one of them was by then we had another member of senior management board who had very little experience or interest in going south. And so I don't think appreciated the nature of the problem we were dealing with and was only interested in it from a UK legal perspective rather than a social and work perspective. I'll give you another incident, not from that season, but another one which staggered me, which also surrounds alcohol, to give you an illustration of the sort of problems. And I'm deliberately not going to use names here because I don't think it's appropriate. But we did have a visit from a member of UK staff who was down for the season. And James Clark Ross was coming in. She was coming in late because of ice. And so there was a rapid turnaround needed. And Jerry was the ship's master at the time, someone whom I got on with very well, a lot of respect for. I'm not sure I'd like to work for him, but got on very well with him. A superb supporter of scientists at sea. I mean, he's the best possible master you could want in charge of a ship that you were using for science.
Jerry.
Now.
Okay, it doesn't matter.
No, name's gone.
Don't worry, carry on.
It may come back to me later. And the ship radioed in to say, you know, we're going to be in Sunday morning, probably around 5 o'clock in the morning. Can you have the mooring crew ready? Because we need a rapid turnaround. We're behind schedule already. We've got to pump oil. We've got to discharge cargo. And we need to be off as soon as possible. But, you know, we are going to have a social event and we are going to beat you at football again. But, you know, within the terms of a normal visit, this was, you know, we need to get going immediately. So we had the management committee around. This was a different base commander at the time. Because it's subsequent to that incident we were talking about before. And we had a meeting, and I vividly remember this visiting member of HQ staff saying, well, they can't come in tomorrow morning. We said, why is that? He said, it's my birthday, and I won't be in a fit state to do anything technical the next morning. And we just looked at each other. You know, outside the confines of the meeting, I went up to the base commander and said, I don't believe I heard that. And he said, no, I don't either. So he called Jerry and said, we've had a slight reaction on this, but please do come in. And Jerry's reaction was, in which case, I'm coming in at bloody 5 o'clock. He speeded up the ship to get it in early, just to make the point. And the guys were there. That guy was out there, but he wasn't actually very with it. But I remember thinking, this used to be a professional organisation. Maybe not everyone thinks of it in the same light. I mean, it was an isolated incident, but it surrounds alcohol and an approach. You know, this is my birthday, therefore I'm going to get drunk, therefore I can't. So, do you know how much it costs to run a research vessel? It was an interesting insight into some of the problems we sometimes have to deal with. But those are, I must emphasise, those are isolated instances, but I've used them as examples of a trend that Bass has to deal with. It's the outside coming in.
I'm surprised you're talking about the 21st century. I mean, I can imagine that in the heroic era,
yeah,
60s and so on, but I'm surprised, partly surprised, because I attended the Girton conference in 2009, I think it would have been, and I was surprised then that some very senior woman from Bath stood up in front of everybody and said, I'm going to talk to you about alcohol,
yeah,
and gave a 10-minute lecture on not getting drunk in the Antarctic. It can cost you your life. And we all went, it could.
And it has. Not in Bath, to my knowledge, but I do know of cases in the Americans where it has. Yes, the trouble is that those lectures and admonitions actually are forgotten about by the time you get down. Mm. And Bath does have an alcohol policy, and it tries its best to make it work, but you're up against a lot of difficulties in, you know, people like their freedom, and there are ways around every regulation, as people will know.
I'm very conscious that we have a luncheon appointment
yes,
any moment now, so let's stop for the time.
Okay, right.